What's the most frequent distraction for teens involved in car crashes? Cell phones? Cell phones are a big hazard, but an even more frequent distraction, passengers. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, startling findings from new studies on teens and driving and recommendations for reducing the number of teens killed on Iowa roads. Before that, Joyce Russell tells us which bills made it out of the second funnel week at the Iowa legislature. The 1969 landmark U.S. Supreme Court Tinker case from Des Moines provides a First Amendment yardstick for a recent case in California. And MacArthur genius and graphic memoirist Alison Bechdel is coming to Iowa. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. We start right after this news from NPR. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Are you the parent of a teen driver? Well, you'll want to stay tuned in just a few minutes. Some startling findings from new studies on teens and driving and recommendations for reducing the number of teens killed on Iowa roads. But first, this week marks the second funnel week for the Iowa legislature. That means in order for a bill to survive, it must have made it out of committee of the opposite chamber. So the Senate out of the House committee and vice versa. With us now to tell us which ones made it and which ones didn't, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hello, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
We've talked about a lot of these on our Monday legislative days, but let's talk about the ones that cleared the funnel. Go ahead, start us off.
Well, among the bills that we've talked about on our legislative days on Mondays, the gun bill did make it through sort of at the last minute, got revived earlier in the week. It looked like it was dead, but House and Senate still differing views on that, on just how Iowa's gun laws should be changed, but it does remain alive.
And remind us what that new law would do.
Oh, well, it's a number of different things. It has to do with child handling of guns. Mm-hmm. It has to do with confidentiality of permits to carry. And in the original version, it would have gotten rid of the permit to acquire a weapon, and that became the most contentious thing. The House has now backed off of that. So the bill is alive. Still, I wouldn't bet on whether it's actually going to get passed, but it's still out there.
Okay. Others that cleared? Yeah.
Yeah. The school start date bill, which we did a program on, has actually passed both and is on its way down to the governor. In the end, the Democratic Senate was not able to get the support it wanted to let schools start whenever they wanted. And so now the bill to have August 23rd is the earliest school start date is on its way to the governor, and it's almost certain he's going to sign it. And then another show that we did last week on juvenile sentencing, that bill is also a live one. And you have to kind of call that an accomplishment because this is a third year that the legislature has tried to address this problem. The courts threw out Iowa's law mandating a life in prison sentence for juvenile offenders. And so the courts had been sort of waiting for the legislature to, okay, if you can't have a mandatory life in prison sentence, what can we give? And so mm-hmm. this bill gives courts three different options. A lot of people are still unhappy with it, but it seems to be the compromise that is going to pass the legislature this year.
I just mentioned some driving and teens and driving studies we'll have coming up in just a moment. A cell phone and driving bill made it out of the funnel?
Yeah, it did. And if I understand this right, it actually got expanded in the House. This is a bill to make texting while driving a primary offense, meaning an officer can actually pull you over for texting while driving. The House took that bill and actually said you can't even use a cell phone unless you have one of those handheld devices. That was kind of an interesting discussion because the argument there was, you know, how can an officer tell if you're texting? Whereas if it's if you can't be handling a cell phone at all, then it would be a lot easier to to make that a primary offense. So that's where that bill is at right now.
Okay, we got just over a minute left, Joyce. Other bills that made it, and perhaps some that didn't clear the funnel.
Well, a couple of bills that didn't clear the funnel. The bill to regulate tanning booths and not let kids do that. Teenagers do that? That one, there's quite a bit of work done on that. In the end, I was told there was a kind of a controversy with the American Cancer Society and a disagreement on what the age limit should be. So that one died. And then we're going to be talking about this bill on Monday, the bill to legislative show on Monday, the bill to regulate these new ride services. Uber is the most well-known or the most recognizable name. And Uber wanted the legislature to pass one set of regulations for Uber when it moves into a community instead of letting communities decide that. And actually, Des Moines had already passed its own ordinance, so there was quite a bit of resistance there. Senator Jeff Danielson is going to be on our show on Monday, and he worked hard on this bill, and he was very optimistic, even going into the Transportation Committee.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, he didn't have the votes. You know, a local control is something that can easily kill a bill, and it looks like that's one of the things that happened.
Okay, Joyce Russell, we have to go. Also to mention here, marijuana penalties will not be lessened. That did not clear the funnel, right?
That's right. One of those died in the last funnel, and the second one died in this funnel.
Okay. We'll talk more on Monday, Legislative Day. Thanks so much, Joyce Russell. Have a great weekend. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Thanks, Joyce.
Okay. Hey, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about news we didn't get to otherwise in our talk shows to round out the week. In just a moment, researchers at the University of Iowa will tell us about a new study that indicates passengers are the most frequent distraction for teens involved in crashes. Sadly, from 2012 to 2013, 43 teens were killed as occupants of motor vehicles on Iowa roads. Iowa could reduce by more than half its rate of motor vehicle accidents that kill teenagers if state lawmakers adopt a stronger graduated driver's license law. Now, that's according to a new national study by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. It's a Virginia-based independent research organization funded by auto insurers. Joining me now, Ann McCart, Senior Vice President for Research at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Hello, Ann.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on to talk about this very important topic. Your institute had several recommendations. Let's go through them. The biggest was what?
Well, we looked at five important components of teen licensing laws, and our research had shown that each of these components was directly related to the rate of crashes. And so probably the two that would make the biggest difference in Iowa would be to have a strong passenger restriction for teen drivers. Our research shows that limiting teen passengers to either one or actually none could reduce the fatal crash rate by up to 21%. We also think that you allow teens to get a learner's permit way too early. If Iowa's law allows someone to get a learner's permit at 14, and we would recommend 16. And I think it's important to point out one unusual thing about Iowa's law is that after several months have passed, a teen with a learner's permit can get what's called a school license, which allows them to drive to and from school. So even when they're without an adult in the vehicle, so even when they have a learner's permit, there's this loophole or exception that allows very young teens to be on the road without an adult in the vehicle.
Right, right. I have a 15-year-old. He doesn't have a license yet, but he has many friends who are driving to and from school already at the age of 15. But, you know, Iowa's is a rural state in many parts, and some kids just need to get in from outside a town or a city to get to school. So that's going to be a tough sell to lawmakers, don't you think?
Well, we recognize that, and when you look at the laws, you can see that the weaker laws tend to be in the very rural farm states. But we're here to point out the negative effects of some of these laws on the safety of teenagers. We recognize that legislators and families have to weigh a variety of factors, but what we're here to say is that allowing teens to be on the road, again, unsupervised, at a really young age compared to other states, does result in higher fatal crash rates and higher collisions reported to insurers. So I think what we're trying to say is think about the safety consequences of these laws.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so talk about why those few years, 14 years old, 15, 16, 17, why they make such a difference to a teenager in behavior behind the wheel.
Well, the two things that result in teens having such a high crash rate are that they're inexperienced drivers. A driver of any age that's inexperienced has a higher crash rate, but teens' inexperience is coupled with what you might call their youthfulness, their immaturity, their inability to always make the best decisions, their propensity to take risk. And part of what's pushing the better safety at older ages for the permit or the license is that even at 16, a teen is more mature compared to someone at 14. So a newly licensed 16-year-old is going to be safer than a newly licensed 15-year-old, or a 17-year-old is going to be safer than a 16-year-old. So even though older teens are still not comparable to adults in terms of their crash rates, the older the teen, the lower the crash rate. And so and another thing I might point out, and I guess this is obvious, but if you don't have a license or a permit, you're not driving, you're not going to crash. So part of it is just exposing teens to the possibility of a crash. And we would just urge Iowa to think about delaying that process.
Mm-hmm. So if the laws don't change, or in the meantime, before they do change, should they change, what can concerned parents of teens do to make their kids safer drivers?
Well, that's a great question, because we really urge parents to think about setting their own rules that go further than the state laws. And so the five things we looked at, we talked about delaying the teen getting the permit, delaying getting the intermediate license. We talked about limiting teen passengers. Another thing is nighttime driving. Iowa has a nighttime restriction that begins at 12:30, but we would recommend it begin earlier than that, at 9 or 10 or even earlier. And finally, an important thing that we point to is practice driving. And Iowa does require 20 hours of practice driving during the permit stage, but again, parents can go way beyond that. And parents make a lot of the decisions about their teens driving, including when they'll get a license. So we urge parents to think about being stricter than Iowa's present laws are.
Mm-hmm. I heard this in a recent conversation on this topic a while ago. A parent said, hey, here's the solution that we have found. We have a teen that gets to driving age in Iowa, 14, 15 years old, and says, listen, if I put you on our car, our insurance rates go up. I'm going to give you all the money that I save by not having you drive from insurance so that you don't drive until later. Is that a good investment, a good deal?
Well, that sounds like very clever parents, yes. And certainly insurance rates do go up. And one thing parents might think about, too, I'll slip it in. I work for the Insurance Institute, and we crash test vehicles, and we have a list of recommended vehicles for teens. Parents should think about the vehicle their teen is driving. Some are much safer than others, and we've found through our research that many teens are in smaller, lighter vehicles that won't provide as much protection. So that's another thing parents might think about, too.
Okay. Ann McCart, Senior Vice President for Research, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, talking to us from Arlington, Virginia. Thank you, Ann McCart.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now, while we have the attention of concerned parents of teen drivers, let's talk about a new study by vehicle safety researchers at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. It's a study that shows passengers passengers, not cell phones, are the most frequent distraction for teen drivers involved in crashes. It's a first-of-its-kind study, and here's what they did. They reviewed video data of nearly 1,700 crashes involving teen drivers between the ages of 16 and 19 and found that distracted driving contributes to nearly 60% of car crashes involving teen drivers. Joining us, two faculty from the source of the study, the Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. We have the division's director, Dan McGeehee, with us, and Cher Carney, senior research scientist at that division. Dan and Cher, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
So, people are wondering, how do you get video data of 1,700 crashes? Because this is quite interesting data.
Yeah, I think this is really where we've had a really long history in looking at what's called naturalistic driving. And 8 years ago, we did the first study of its kind in the U.S. where we put little video cameras, little crash recorder type cameras, in a group of about 35 teenagers at Clear Creek Amana High School. And that was really sort of the basis of this overall crash study. It was the first time that we were able to sort of get a view inside of the vehicle. We use that to sort of enhance young drivers' ability to drive. But one of the byproducts of putting these little recorders in vehicles is that we get crashes.
Mm-hmm. And you get crashes, so it's a split screen. If you'd like to see what these look like, it's not easy watching, I have to tell you. Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, and you'll see a compilation of some of the crashes. There are no deaths in the ones that we show.
Right. We did not have any fatal crashes in our study.
Okay. So you don't have to be worried about that. But it is harrowing watching, nevertheless. Cher Carney, you watched how many of these videos?
We looked at almost 7,000 crashes, but this study was based on a review of almost 1,700.
Mm-hmm. So you have that split screen. You see what's going on. The camera is on the rearview mirror, and there's a camera facing outward, where the car is going out to the road, and then there's an interior camera that shows the driver, teen driver, very often listening to the radio, chatting with someone in the car, and very often texting, or just, it's amazing how many things, not just teens, but all of us drivers get up to when we're behind the wheel besides driving, Dan.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about these data, as you mentioned, 60% of the of our crashes had distraction present. In previous data from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that looked at police-reported data, only about 14% of crashes had distraction present. So we really see an overwhelming increase in what's reported from the police versus what we actually see in the real world.
Is that the difference between teen and adult drivers, or we just think that this data is better data for, can apply to most all drivers?
Yeah, well, this is among the teen population specifically.
Oh, I see. So it was 15% reported by the police. So this is a significantly higher number. Why did you get so much more distraction in your study?
Well, I think part of it is just how police can sort of capture what are self-reported at the scene. Most people don't admit that to being on a phone or having a bunch of distraction in the back seat prior to a crash. So those things are oftentimes not visible to law enforcement when they do their investigation around a crash. Whereas we sort of have the ground truth. We see into the vehicle, we see outside of the vehicle, so we can sort of see what's present there.
Cher Carney, as you reviewed these videos of crashes, what came to the fore? What are the most what type of behavior leads to crashes in terms of distraction?
Well, in 15% of the crashes we reviewed, there was some type of passenger distraction present. That means the driver was either looking at or talking with the person next to them or behind them. 12% of the crashes had cell phone use present, and the large majority of that was texting.
Okay. And you see that in the video that we posted on our Facebook page. What about external factors? Are those leading to crashes? Is that what you looked at as well?
We did see that was one of the top three distractions were people looking outside of the vehicle at some place that we couldn't tell exactly what they were looking at.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more, Dan McGehee, about, because you broke down why crashes happened. Take us through that in a little bit more detail.
So what's unique about this particular system is that we see about 12 seconds before a crash. It sort of operates much like your DVR, your TiVo at home, where the system is always on, but it doesn't record until it actually gets sort of an abrupt event like steering or braking or a crash. So then it can go back in time 12 seconds. And then we take that 12 seconds and sort of go through that frame by frame and look what is present in terms of the different behaviors leading up to the impact. Mm-hmm. So are there passengers there? Are there interaction? Were they looking away, typing away at their phone, and so forth?
So a lot of these videos, and if you watch that, it's simply you don't have your eyes on the road.
Right.
You're going around the curve. You don't have your eyes on the road. You're driving at night, and you're looking down in your lap at your cell phone.
Yes. It's pretty remarkable to see the kinds of behaviors out there across the board. I mean, while this particular study just looked at teens, and I should say this was sponsored by the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety, certainly adults, especially young adults and middle-aged adults, are now, the cell phone is ubiquitous in their lives as well. So they're addicted to their cell phones just like teenagers are as well.
Okay, so the takeaway here for concerned parents and any teens listening, the more passengers you have on board, share the greater likelihood of a distracted crash?
The more passengers there are, the larger the number of distractions. There's more moving around in the vehicle, more horsing around, and the volume inside the vehicle increases considerably as well.
Mm-hmm. And as far as texting, we know we can be talking on our smartphones, we can be texting, we can be, unfortunately, we've been watching videos. So the more involved you are with your cell phone, the greater the distraction.
Right. I think if you take a look at all of us, especially teens, are Snapchatting and Instagram. There's so much social media. You know, literally every week there is a new social media application to interact with. So it's something that we are constantly doing, and we're constantly interrupted. So if you think about driving, we get interrupted by our cell phones a lot. So it's really that ill-timed glance away from the road that can really be the one that leads to a crash.
Based on the data, 1,700 crashes figured into this first-of-a-kind study. What is the takeaway for Iowa lawmakers here? What would you like to be have the takeaway be?
Well, one of the things is that we've recently, in the last year, changed our graduated driver licensing system in the state to have a passenger limit. However, included in that limit, in that law, was that parents can opt out of the law, which is sort of very unique nationally, that you can choose to opt out of a particular law, which renders it rather ineffective.
And how many do opt out?
Right now, 90%,
wow.
93% is the latest number, have opted out of this law. So
that's
you can
hardly a law, is it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So this kind of study really helps us with the data to be able to go back to lawmakers and say, you know, distraction with passengers is really a key issue in crashes. And, you know, over 40 kids a year in the state of Iowa lose their lives in car crashes. It's the number one cause of death for our youngest.
Mm-hmm. And so the message to lawmakers might be, get rid of this opt-out.
Yes, I think that would be one key, and that helps to serve to educate the Iowans out there that this is really a serious issue.
Okay, Dan McGehee, Director of the Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Cher Carney, thank you for being with us, a senior research scientist there. Cher and Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, the 1969 landmark U.S. Supreme Court Tinker case from Des Moines provides a First Amendment yardstick for a recent case in California. MacArthur genius and graphic memoirist Allison Bechtel joins me. She's coming to Iowa next week. And also, your April Iowa Arts Showcase. Your Friday News Buzz continues after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
So glad you're along on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, I speak with MacArthur genius Allison Bechtel. She's coming to Drake University next week to discuss her groundbreaking memoir, Fun Home. Allison grew up in a funeral home. But first, in its decision in 1969 in the case Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District, the U.S. Supreme Court defined the constitutional rights of students in public schools. The so-called Tinker Test is still used by courts today to determine whether a school's disciplinary actions violate students' First Amendment rights. In fact, it was used within the past few days to decide a case in California. Here to tell us about that case, Ryan Copeman's attorney at Nymaster Good in Des Moines. Hello again, Ryan.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for being with us. Now, remind us what took place. The Tinker case of 1969, outline that for us.
So this is one of those cases that, first of all, we're very proud, right? It's an Iowa case. It comes out of Des Moines, and so many of us are familiar, generally at least, with the history of it. But it took place during the beginning of the Vietnam War, and as the Vietnam War was starting to become controversial, it was 1965, and a group of Des Moines students wanted to wear black armbands to school in protest and to commemorate this proposed Christmas ceasefire. Some teachers, though, got word of this, that the students were going to come with these black armbands, and so the school board quickly passed a rule that said any student wearing a black armband will be suspended. A few students did it anyway, and that would include Mary Beth Tinker and John Tinker, brother and sister, along with some of their other siblings and one other student. They wore the armbands to school and were indeed suspended. They sued the school, and kind of what is probably every high school, middle school student's dream, who's civically active, they took their case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said in a 7-2 vote that the Tinkers were right and the Des Moines School District was wrong.
And that has been looked at and is part of jurisprudence in this country, a main precedent here. So why has it come up again in California in this recent case? What's that case about?
Well, that's a very similar case. Here we have, it's Cinco de Mayo, and you have this California school, and so students are celebrating, especially those with Mexican heritage. And you have some Caucasian students who wear T-shirts to school with the American flag on it.
Okay, and to be clear, Cinco de Mayo is a celebration of Independence Day for Mexico, right?
Exactly, exactly. Of course, Cinco de Mayo only meaning the 5th of May. It doesn't have significance for us necessarily, just like the 4th of July doesn't have significance across the world, but it's part of Mexican heritage, and so obviously this wearing of the American flag was somewhat of a statement by these Caucasian students, and one that really perhaps wasn't very welcome by those students with Mexican heritage.
Mm-hmm. And so this California high school decided to forbid them from wearing these American flag T-shirts, right?
Exactly. Told the students they needed to turn their shirts inside out. They weren't allowed to wear them because they were worried that this was going to start kind of some racial violence. There was no violence that happened. There was a little bit of a back and forth between one student who went up to another who was wearing this flag shirt and said, "Why are you wearing that? Do you not like Mexicans?" And then other students reported this conversation to the principal, who then said, "Off with the shirts."
Okay, and what did the Ninth Circuit court decide in this case?
So Ninth Circuit said the school was right. So we have this kind of reversal, right? It seems very similar to the Tinker case, but given what had happened the previous year, in which there was some altercation, but only verbal altercation between some Caucasian and Hispanic students, and this one little altercation, the principal thought, well, it was, you know, I had a reasonable degree, and what the Ninth Circuit said is that the school authorities had reasonably believed that there might be substantial disruption of school, and that's kind of the test. That's what came out of Tinker, and that's kind of where we come full circle. So the Tinkers became involved in this case. They hired a lawyer, or perhaps a lawyer did this for free for them, and they wrote what's called an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they said, we think that this Ninth Circuit case is wrong, and we think it directly conflicts with our case, our victory that we had 40 years ago, and we want you to take it up. And the Tinkers aren't really alone in doing that, because although their case has been kind of this First Amendment symbol for many, many years, and it's this famous quote that says, you know, students do not shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. And so we think of it as a free speech case and a victory for free speech. But it's one of those cases that has a little bit for everyone in it, because there's also some language that really that the Ninth Circuit pulled out that suggests if there's any threat of disruption, then the school can come in and kind of stamp this out. And so what you have here is a concern. Well, if they can stop someone from wearing an American flag T-shirt, what can't they stop them from wearing? I mean, what about political parties, for example? I mean, mm-hmm. as divisive as our politics are these days, it seems like that could cause some disruption.
Okay. Yeah, so will this case go further than the Ninth Circuit?
It won't. We will continue to be in limbo. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled at the beginning of this week. They said we will not hear the case. So the Ninth Circuit decision stands, and we will have to wait a little bit more to find out what schools can do to restrict speech and what they can't do, which will likely come back, probably most likely, in terms of bullying. What we're seeing now is schools actually regulating speech that happens off campus. So this tinker issue will probably just grow, and someday the court will probably have to weigh in again.
So, Ryan, what is your thoughts on why the U.S. Supreme Court didn't take this case?
Well, we never really know. Maybe the court just thought this wasn't the right case, but maybe the justices are starting to think that the Tinker case is a little outdated, and they want to see how it plays out. Obviously, this school in California, which had police officers standing outside of it and which had serious racial fights in the past, was not probably the same as the high school that the Tinkers went to in Des Moines in 1965. So schools are changing. The violence is increasing. We probably wouldn't have really thought about guns in school in 1965. And so maybe the court is just waiting to see what happens, and they don't want to decide this new Tinker case too early.
So you're looking for the type of case that may make it eventually to the Supreme Court to retest the Tinker test, if I can say it that way, would be, you think, a bullying case.
It very well could be. I think.
What would be the scenario? Give me a likely scenario.
Well, for example, now schools may be able to regulate conduct that happens on Facebook, conduct that happens on Twitter. And suppose that a group of students are kind of directing their comments at another one, perhaps making some general racial comments about a certain race. Generally, things we think about would be obviously not good to say, but if you or I were out in the public, we were having shouting this out down the streets, and no one can do anything to us. Those are our First Amendment rights. But now schools may be punishing children, kids, for making these kind of general political and sometimes not very popular opinions on Facebook because it makes other students feel bad. And it's obviously a very serious problem, bullying, but it comes with very serious First Amendment implications.
So Ryan, has this landmark case from 1969, Tinker, been tested this way up to now?
No, not really. I mean, that's one of the strange things. It really hasn't taken a look at what I will call political speech since Tinker. They've dealt with things about, you know, what can newspaper editors say? Can the school kind of govern what their school newspapers have? And they're talking about just plain obscenity, those kinds of things. But they really haven't gone back to this, I'm making a political expression like they have here. There was another case where the student at a parade, like a pep rally, held up a sign that said, "Bong hits for Jesus." That was a few years ago, and essentially what the Supreme Court kind of dodged Tinker. People thought they may be going to revisit it then and look at it then, but instead they just said, well, look, even though that it's bong hits for Jesus, it's nonsensical, really what it's doing is it's advocating drug use, and obviously schools can stop students from promoting drug use. So the answer, I guess, I mean, there's things that are biting along the outside of it, but the court hasn't directly looked at one of these political speech cases since Tinker.
Okay, thank you very much. Ryan Copeman's attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines, pointing out the relevance of the landmark 1969 case, Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District, to a case recently in California, and it looks like on into the future. Ryan Copeman's, thanks again.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Celebrated cartoonist and graphic memoirist and MacArthur Fellow Alison Bechtel will be appearing in Iowa three times next week, Monday evening at Drake University, at noon on Wednesday at Grinnell College, and the evening of Thursday, April 9th at Iowa State University. She's well known for her long-running comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For. And in 2006, her graphic memoir, Fun Home, was named Book of the Year by Time, by the New York Times, several other publications also naming it Best Book of the Year. Last year, Bechdel was awarded the MacArthur Genius Award for, quote, redefining paradigms in memoir. The presentation she is coming to Iowa to give is called Drawing Lessons, the Comics of Everyday. And Allison Bechdel joins me now. Hello, Allison.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us a little bit about the theme of the talks you'll be giving here in Iowa next week.
Well, I'll mostly just be talking about myself.
All right.
As a memoirist, that's kind of my topic. But I've been writing about myself for a long time, even when I wasn't explicitly writing memoir. For many years, I drew a comic strip called Dykes to Watch Out For, which was about people very much like me, a fictional community of lesbians. But it wasn't actually autobiographical.
When you first created your comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For, in the 1980s, you really captured the lives of women in the lesbian community as they were influenced by cultural, political events of the day. And you said then that you did it in part because you didn't see an accurate reflection of you or your friends in the cultural mirror. Now, 30 years later, do you think LGBT representation in mainstream media, in culture, has evolved?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, when I was young, there was nothing and no very, very few mainstream images, but maybe a few that were sort of, you know, terrible stereotypes, but it's much better now. Still not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was.
What do you see specifically as lacking that makes you groan, perhaps, when you experience it?
You know, I'm not so sure about right this moment, but I know that around the turn of the century, right around 2000, there was like a gay person in every other network television show.
Right.
And they all felt like sort of, you know, just not quite right. Like they were well-intentioned, but, you know, I guess, you know, any character in a mainstream TV show is going to be oversimplified, but I just found that all a little dismaying.
Mm-hmm. Allison, your work is incredibly personal, and you take us to places as private as therapy sessions, to bathrooms, and we feel even more so they're personal because you've recreated them visually. And I'm wondering, what is it like to almost compulsively recreate the details of painful moments of your life? For instance, a breakup letter from a former girlfriend, for instance, and then display them for everybody to take in.
Well, you're right. It is a compulsion. I sort of have to do this stuff. I'm not quite sure why. I'm a little actually appalled sometimes when I look at the intimate material from my life that I've revealed to the public. But somehow I have to do it. I guess it's sort of. I was raised Catholic, and I loved going to confession.
You love you. I was raised Catholic too. I guess I can't say that about going to confession.
Well, I didn't enjoy actually going in there and talking to the priest, but I liked what happened afterward when you got like forgiven for everything.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
That feeling of absolution, and I think that's what I'm searching for when I you know make these confessions in my memoir writing.
Mm-hmm. When you went into confession as a young girl, did you tell absolutely the truth about what you had sinned for?
Oh, God. Well, you know, that was so ridiculous. What kind of sins can a 7-year-old perpetrate? I would make stuff up, you know?
Okay.
I would say I stole chewing gum when, of course, I had never done any such thing.
Allison, there's a scene in your memoir, Fun Home, where you go back through a childhood journal and you write, I think, after every declarative sentence you had previously written. And there's this very present doubt of your own recollections. How has that influenced your work as a memoirist?
This is also a Catholic damage thing. I was afraid of, very afraid of sinning in any way, and lying was like the most concrete sin I could get my mind around as a little kid. And I was very afraid of inadvertently telling a lie by saying something that I really wasn't absolutely sure was true. Like if I said, Mom went uptown to the store, I realized I didn't really know that. Like maybe she'd been abducted by aliens on her way to the store, and you know. So, but that kind of doubt, I guess, I think is very healthy for a memoirist. Like you never, there's a lot that you don't know and that you have to, I like memoirs where that doubt is brought to the foreground, where you, you don't pretend that you have the complete version, you know? So I think that helps to make a memoir better when you, because people want to believe, the whole point of memoir is that it really happened, it's true.
You've spoken, Alison Bechtel, a lot about the inherent narcissism present in being a memoirist. And as you said, you're coming to Iowa to talk about yourself and writing about yourself. When you're making your art, what are you trying to do for the audience? Or is the audience not part of the equation when you're writing it? Are they always in your mind?
When I was writing my comic strips, I was always very conscious of my audience and very influenced by them. People would send me suggestions for storylines or characters I should have. And I was very tuned into who I was writing for. But when I started writing about my own life, I felt like I didn't have a clear sense anymore of who was going to be reading this stuff. I felt like I was telling a very quirky, weird story, and I couldn't imagine who my audience was going to be. So I stopped thinking about them, and I just figured I'd tell the story I needed to tell.
And that turned out to be the right track.
It worked out pretty well, yeah. So
I think pretty well is understated by a large margin. Alison Bechtel, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining me for a few minutes. You'll be in Iowa three times next week at Drake on Monday evening at noon at Grinnell College and at Iowa State University on Thursday, April 9th in the evening. Alison Bechtel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, we are joined by Jacqueline Hallbloom, Iowa Public Radio classical music host of the monthly Iowa Arts Showcase. Hello, Jacqueline.
Hello, Ben. Great to be here.
Yeah, we always like to check in with you at the beginning of the month to find out what's coming up on your program. It airs 11 a.m. on Saturday, tomorrow, Saturday, April 3rd, and 5 p.m. So tell us, lots happening this month. We don't have much time. What's going on? A Russian pianist coming.
He is amazing and has an amazing story behind his start to being a musician. He's going to be the make good for the Civic Music Association's 90th anniversary year concert. That's going to be on May 1st. It's going to be brilliant. Don't miss it. He's doing a fantastic concert.
Northern Iowa Jazz Band One's collaboration coming up with Jack Cooper. Who's he?
Jack Cooper is a professor of music and a really cool guy, composer and arranger. And he is taking music of Charles Ives and jazzing it up. And they're bringing him in, and they're going to have also a trio. It's going to be an amazing concert. Charles Ives and jazz, an interesting mix.
Mm-hmm. In Fort Dodge, the African American Museum of Iowa hosting a Music of Protest conference later in the month. What's that about?
Well, Celeste Bembry, who is really into the Negro spiritual, is going to be doing this special workshop about the songs of protest. This is the civil rights movement. That will be on April 20th at the Fort Dodge Public Library. And then she's going to be doing this marvelous festival of spirituals, and that's going to be on May 3rd in Waterloo. And just a marvelous chance to really dig in and find out more about the Negro spiritual and its major influence on American music and its importance in American music.
Libby Larson is on your agenda for the program. Tell us about that.
She is coming to Iowa. This woman has written over 500 works, 13 operas. She is amazing, and she's going to be working on the UNI campus, doing a residency, working with students, composing with students, and also with the bands and the orchestras. It's going to be a great experience and a wonderful chance to see her and hear this music, and it's all free.
Mm. And finally, there is a child prodigy coming to perform at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in the middle of April. This is an amazing young lady, Emily Baer. Tell us about her, and we're going to take the show out with a little bit of her original music. But for those who don't know, who is Emily Baer?
So what were you doing when you were 13 years old, Ben?
A lot of time at the baseball park, football, getting dirty, playing in the creek, I guess.
Well, Emily Baer is amazing, and she's a pianist, she's a composer, she's an arranger. an arranger, and she calls Quincy Jones her mentor. He has taken her under his wing. She's has six CDs out now. She's performed with symphony orchestras, and she's bringing her jazz trio with her to the Gallagher Blue Dorn. That concert is going to be coming up on April 18th. And in fact, she's going to be appearing part of Studio One here coming up on the 17th over the noon hour. So we hope folks will tune in for that as well.
An amazing young woman. Well, thank you for sharing with us what's coming up this month on the April Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio Classical, 11 a.m. Saturday and 5 p.m. Saturday. Let's go out with a little bit of Emily Bear. I think you've got something ready for us. What is it there, Jacqueline?
This is from her Diversity release and a work that she composed, The Northern Lights.
Jacqueline Hallbloom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.